to play with the fire extinguisher. In my defense, 5 spice white rats are delicious. Anyway, I can still tell a story because, as I have stated before, I know things. As it turns out, Sammy and the cheese were less than successful at finding the ignition key to the taxman's Chrysler. But after 10 minutes with the Moon Man's tools and the penknife from Jimmy Vasco's keychain, the Chrysler thundered to life. The cheese emerged from under the dash with a sly grin and a pair of pliers. "Ready?" she asked. "It's got fluid drive transmission, no shifting." "Okie dokie," said Sammy, as he had no idea what she was talking about, and was still adding, "Where did you learn to hotwire a car?" to his mental list of things he meant to ask her about when she came up with a trunk key she found in the glove box. "Ta-da," she said. Before they pulled out, the cheese opened the trunk to stash the Moon Man's blanket, and they found Pookie O'Hara lying in repose, with various fluids leaking out of him, quite dead. "So why won't Uncle Ho get rid of the body?" asked the cheese. "Mushu says it takes too long for the pigs to eat a white devil." "They keep pigs in the city?" "The Chinese are an ancient and mysterious people," Sammy told her. "Right," said the cheese. "Let's drag him out of here so he's not near the gas tank." They stood 20 feet away, wearing the taxman's sunglasses, the Chrysler idling in the background, while the Moon Man let loose on Pookie's remains with his cow blaster. Sammy noticed the froggy membrane cover the Moon Man's eyes just before he shot. A good tell to remember. "When I should scrape him up?" asked the cheese after the flash. "Nah, the Moon Man's got his hat and I got his badge to remember him by. Let him blow away." They left the pile of fine white ash there in the motel parking lot as Sammy steered the Ford out onto the road, followed by Stilton and the Moon Man in the Chrysler. An hour later, they were sitting in Cookie's Coffee with Mooshoes, Milo, and Lone Jones, making a plan, leaving the Moon Man to relax in the trunk of the Chrysler with his hat and his blaster. "So you're not worried about the kid?" Milo asked. "The kid'll be fine," Sammy told him. "He's a horrible little kid," Mooshoes added. "I could use a change of clothes," said the cheese. "How about I run by my place real quick?" "They know where you live, Dal. How about you go with Lonius? Myrtle's probably got some fresh togs." "I'll drive you," said Milo. "He's only saying that because he knows you have a car," Sammy said. "That's true," Milo said. "And don't let the Moon Man drive," Sammy said. "He did good coming here," said the cheese. "I had to work the pedals for him, but otherwise he drives like a champ." "Well, I could drive like a champ too, sitting on your lap, Dal," said Milo. The guys all gave him the hairy eyeball. Lone Jones shook his head slowly at Milo, like it might have been a crying shame he had just witnessed. "Sorry," Milo said, trying to shrink into his coffee cup with little success. "None of you guys ever brought a dame in here before. I don't know how to act." Stilton patted his arm across the table. "That's okay, sweetie." Then, changing the subject, "Hey, any of you guys know where I can find an arc welder in the wee hours?" "Sure," said Milo, perked up from being newly washed of his sins. "Birch Garage down on Hyde is one, and he opens up at 5. You guys know it. The joint where I took you to look at the dames and a Snap-on tool calendar." "You guys are creepy, you know that?" said the cheese. "Guys," I explained. "Y'all just sad," said Lone Jones. It was so early, the streetlights were still on, but Sammy and Mooshoes were hoofing it down Stockton Street, just as the fishermen were delivering their catches, and the trucks were arriving from up and down the coast. You can buy a lot of things in Chinatown you don't find for sale down by Fisherman's Wharf. "Fur Manchu?" Sammy read from the sign on a shop that was still closed. "Really?" "That's for Anglos," said Moo. "Chinese don't name their businesses based on English puns for themselves." "What's that one?" Sammy asked, pointing to a sign in Chinese. "Place of Abounding Longevity," Moo translated. "Tea store." "That one?" "Expanding Prosperity Drugstore," read Mooshoes. "You people are big on promises," Sammy said. "Nah, they're big on luck. Did I tell you about the I Ching?" "That's the coin and stick thing, like dice, right?" "It's more like a horoscope, except you're throwing the stars."
"Hogwash, then?"
"Oh, complete hogwash. How about that thing?" Eddie nodded to a truck driver dragging a skate, a speckled ray-like fish about 4 feet long, across the sidewalk into the fish shop.
"Yeah, it's perfect. But we're going to have to get the car. We can't drag that thing on foot."
"No problem," said Eddie.
You're sure this is the angle you want to play?
Yeah, as long as the women who work for Uncle Ho can do the sewing.
They can do it, but he's not going to be happy about it.
We'll get him a better snake, one that's smaller but just as deadly. Barker is coming through town again next month.
I guess that's the song, Armstrong. You go get the car.
By the time Sammy and Eddie Mooshoes left Chinatown, they had purchased the skate ray, an enormous, spiky monkfish, with a mouth you could get your head in, if you wanted your head to be shredded on hundreds of needle-like teeth, and a giant octopus that had just been trucked down from Seattle and was still squirming. Although it was not your Jules Verne pull-the-ship-under giant octopus, but your basic giant Pacific octopus. And the one they bought was maybe big enough to spread out across a sun umbrella, with arms maybe 4 feet long. Much of this seafood salad was sticking out of the rumble seat of Jimmy Vasco's Ford coupe, as they drove it to Uncle Ho's to be assembled.
Sammy called his apartment a little before 8 in the morning.
Yeah,
answered Bailey.
Took your time.
You busy? Sammy said. Want me to call back later? No problem. Bye.
No, Bailey barked.
No, sorry. No, right now is fine.
Sammy, that you? Yelled the kid. You're out of milk. Cornflakes, too.
You have the subject? Asked Bailey.
Yeah, I got it. But I'm not bringing it there. Someplace public.
It can't be public, said Bailey. Obviously.
Okay, said Sammy. Then neutral ground.
Fine. Meet us in the parking lot of Mary Vasco's place in an hour.
What the fuck is Mary Vasco?
The lesbian club owner.
You mean Jimmy? Jimmy's joint?
Yes.
Well, then why didn't you just say Jimmy's joint?
I don't know.
These moron fucks ate all the cornflakes, Sammy,
yelled a kid.
I say knock their blocks off.
Kid's a gem, ain't he? Said Sammy.
He couldn't help but grin.
1 hour. Bring the subject. Don't try to pull anything either. We know about you.
Really? What do you know, tax man?
There was a pause. Bailey shuffled through his notebook.
Well, I know that your real name is Samuel Tuffalo Jr. I know where you live. I know you don't have a service record. And I know you're working without a social security number.
Oh, yeah, you do know stuff. See you in an hour at Jimmy's. Bring the kid.
Sammy hung up and turned to Mooshoes, who was standing by him at the payphone.
These mugs really think I'm Italian.
Milo called Cookie's line while you were inside. The cheese says that the Chrysler isn't ready.
He didn't call the cheese to her face, did he?
Probably it's Milo.
Well, we can't take the moon man to them in the rumble seat.
I'll call Milo back at the garage, said Mooshoes. He can bring the cab.
Where are we going?
To Uncle Ho's, then to Jimmy's joint at Pier 29.
That's a lot of driving for Milo all at once.
I think he's getting better, Sammy said. I think the cheese has cured him.
Across town at Sammy's place, Hatch was field-stripping the new .45 he'd bought at the all-night gun store. Across from him at Sammy's little breakfast counter, Bailey had the parts of his new .45 laid out in front of him.
When you're ready, said Hatch, say go.
Chapter 25. There Will Be Donuts. Bailey and Hatch had an hour of sleep between them over the last 2 days, and even when they tried to sleep in shifts at Sammy's apartment, the kids started mouthing off and waking them up. They tried gagging the kid, but he had a stuffed-up nose and proceeded to suffocate, which degraded his value as a hostage more than somewhat. And while Hatch was very large on knocking the kid out with a skillet to the melon, Bailey had no training in knocking out a kid, and feared that the kid might succumb to their pent-up enthusiasm. So they settled on locking the kid in the closet, which helped not at all, since when the kid dozed, they did not see him. And just as each of them was thinking the coast was clear and started to doze off himself, the kid launched into much pounding and calling of names, as was his habit. They arrived at Jimmy's joint a half hour early, only to find Sammy leaning on the back of a taxicab, like he had been there all day, smoking and drinking a cup of Joe. The cars in the lot were parked in such a way that there was only a narrow corridor for the Chrysler to pull into. They rolled slowly toward the bartender, who gestured for them to turn their car around and then back in.
"Is this guy messing with us?" asked Hatch.
"Sammy's gonna moitalize you mugs," said the kid.
"That's not a word, kid," said Bailey.
"Not yet it ain't," said the kid. "Just you wait."
Bailey flipped a car around and backed in until Sammy signaled he was close enough. Hatch was in the back seat,
holding the kid. They climbed out and positioned the kid between them.
"Stop right there," Sammy said when they were about 20 feet away. They stopped.
"You have the subject?" Bailey asked.
Sammy opened the trunk of Milo's cab. There was a canvas tarp with a short figure lying under it.
"Let's see it," said Hatch.
Sammy threw back one side of the tarp. The creature was laid out, as if for a wake. Sammy stepped aside so they could get a good look. They saw a wide, flat gray torso, from the center of which sprouted a mass of thick red arms, lined with suction cups. Atop the torso was what must have been the head, a black, needle-toothed maw, more than a foot across, surrounded by wicked spikes that jutted out in every direction. Hatch recoiled at the sight. "Holy!
A Martian!" gasped the kid.
"You're right about the spikes," Sammy said.
"You pansies are in for it now," said the kid.
Bailey and Hatch reached inside their jackets.
"Stop," Sammy said.
Car doors on either side of them were kicked open. On one side, Eddie Mushu's was lying on the front seat of a Chevy, pointing a .45 Colt at them. On the other, Milo had another Colt trained on the taxman. Bailey and Hatch froze.
"Sammy brought his nip spy friend," said the kid. "Those guys are tricky. They've a way to hit you that makes your eyeballs explode."
Sammy said, "Hands out of your jacket, slowly and empty."
"I lived through the Battle of the Bulge," said Milo. "I'm not squeamish about seeing a guy's guts blown out." "Who's that guy, Sammy?" said the kid. "He's the tits. Hey, buddy, you want to be my new uncle? You'd have to give up the stupid cabbie hat."
"Send the kid over," Sammy said. Bailey and Hatch let the kid go and held their hands limply out to their sides, like they were dripping paint and didn't want to get it on themselves. The kid's hands were tied, but he turned and started to sand the soles of his shoes across the toes of first Bailey's, then Hatch's shiny black shoes. When both were completely scuffed up, the kid ran over and stood behind Sammy.
"You fucks," said the kid.
"That will buff out," Sammy said. "He had a nice shine on those stompers. Shinola?"
"Kiwi," said Hatch.
Bailey glared at his partner.
"Yeah, kiwi is best for a spit shine," Sammy said.
"Mr. Tufflow, that is government property behind you," said Bailey. "If you don't turn that over to us, you are committing an act of treason.
And you mugs kidnapping a kid, murdering an Air Force general and a dame. That was just in the wrong place at the wrong time? Was that just being patriotic?"
"That was not standard operating procedure," said Bailey. "Special orders."
"These orders come from the same people who gave you the background on me?"
"I can't tell you that."
"Okay," Sammy said. He reached into his jacket pocket and came out with a pair of sunglasses, exactly like the ones that Bailey and Hatch were wearing, except not all bent up. He held them up so the two could get a good look at them. "The guys who gave you your orders, they tell you about this?"
"You guys can have this pair."
Sammy threw one of the pairs of sunglasses on the tarp with the Martian. "I'm keeping this pair." He pocketed the shades. Bailey and Hatch looked at each other.
"I give you this thing," Sammy said. "Are the guys who gave you orders going to come after me and my friends?"
"What happened to Potter and Clarence?" asked Hatch.
Sammy shrugged. "Might never be heard from again. Might have run off together. Might be hunting you two right now."
"We haven't killed anyone," said Hatch.
"Something is going on in Washington, something out of order." Bailey cringed, then shrugged, nodded.
"That's the truth. We never saw Potter and Clarence before 2 nights ago."
Sammy waved to the Martian. "I'd say that's out of order, wouldn't you?" He reached into his coat pocket, pulled out the Walther.
"Look, gents, I'm going to give you this thing, but you have to promise to forget everything about where it came from. Now I'm going to come take your guns. If you move or try to get the drop on me, I'm going to shoot you. Or my friend, the cab driver, is going to shoot you. Or my friend on the other side is going to shoot in your general direction."
"No idea what I'm doing," said Mushu's. "Probably will kill you all by accident."
"That's the spirit," said the kid. "Blast the sons of bitches."
"Shut up, kid," Sammy said. "I'm saving you."
He gently took the .45s from each agent and threw them onto the car, where Mushu's was lying on the front seat.
"Now open your trunk and go get your creature," Sammy said. "Lift it by the tarp. You don't want to touch the subject. That's what happened to Sal."
"Thought so," said Hatch. "How, though, if the subject was at Bohemian Grove?"
"Delayed reaction," Sammy said.
The general showed it to Sal when he first arrived, before he even unloaded it from his plane, and like a dope, Sal touched it. A few hours later, I find him in a puddle in the back room of the saloon. Why didn't you pack him in ice? Well, your guys told me to. Potter and Clarence? I guess, Sammy said. I never saw them. I got a phone call, lots of threats. When I saw you mugs at the saloon, I thought you were the ones on the phone. That's why I pretended to be the janitor. Bailey nodded, as if it was all falling into place. Sammy backed off, keeping the Walther trained on Bailey, as he opened the trunk of the Chrysler. They carefully moved the Martian out of Milo's trunk and slid it into the Chrysler, holding only the edge of the canvas. When Bailey slammed the trunk and turned around, Sammy said, "You know they're not telling you anything. I don't mean everything, I mean anything. You know that, right?" Bailey looked at him, lifted his sunglasses, looked Sammy in the eye. "Yeah, I know." "So," Sammy said, lowering the gun, "are they going to leave us alone? Or are a bunch more people going to get scragged because some general in New Mexico went loopy and tried to impress some knobs?" Bailey let his sunglasses drop. "I haven't filed a report since this started. Everything kept changing." "Which means what?" "You keep your mouth shut. You and your friends should be fine," said Bailey. "We don't hurt civilians." "Yet the evidence says you were lying like a rug. Like Hatch, the other agent said, that didn't come from our people." "And who did it come from?" "Someone over our people. I can't say who, but someone high up." "High enough that you guys can ice a general?" Hatch nodded. "You gonna give us back our guns?" "Nope." Again, Hatch nodded, just a twitch of a nod. "You're sure this thing hasn't moved?" "I'd keep an eye on it, how are you?" Sammy said. "Drop the seat of the Chrysler. It goes right through to the trunk, right?" Again, the nod. "Where are you taking it?" Sammy said. "I can't tell you that," Bailey said. "Long drive?" "Maybe," said Hatch. "Look," Sammy said, "I don't know what happened to your other guys, but last anyone saw them, they were near that thing." "Who saw them?" "I can't tell you that," Sammy said. "Tell your bosses to leave us alone, or better yet, don't tell them anything. Time for you to go." Sammy waved him back into the car with the Walther, waited, then watched as the big black Chrysler rumbled away. 5 minutes later, an almost identical Chrysler jumped the curb at the Embarcadero, sending a hubcap wheeling down the wharf into the bay, then squealed around and stopped where Sammy was waiting behind Jimmy Vasquez's Ford coupe. The Moon Man, under Pookie O'Hara's big fedora, was driving. Stilton jumped out of the passenger side. "He's a natural." She was holding the Moon Man's coronet blaster. She was wearing Myrtle's gray slacks and a white blouse. "You let him drive?"
"Yeah, of course. I cut the pedals off, welded some half-inch stock on as extensions, then welded the pedals back on. Fluid drive. Automatic transmission. That's a wonder."
The Moon Man hung his head out the window and chattered.
"Where's Milo and Moose Shoes?" asked the cheese.
"Moose Shoes went home to sleep. Milo is picking up Jimmy Vasco and Myrtle to bring them here. The kid's off getting some breakfast." "Why do you have that thing?" Sammy nodded to the blaster.
"Oh, I stopped by my place to see if I could blast out a rumpus room. Turns out you have to be a Moon Man for it to work. I can't blast a stinking thing."
She handed it through the window to the Moon Man.
"Be nice," she said. Then to Sammy, "Give me your jacket."
"Why? What?"
"Just get everything out of the pockets and give me your jacket. The hat is okay from a distance, but he's going to need a better outfit."
While Sammy transferred the contents of his jacket pockets into his trouser pockets, Stilton coaxed the Moon Man out of the Chrysler and stood him up behind the Ford, where no one from the road could see him.
"Give me your jacket," she said.
Sammy took off his jacket and handed it to her, then watched as she put it on the Moon Man. It hung to the ground on him. She rolled up the sleeves until his froggy little hand showed again, but he was still swimming in it.
"Give me your tie," she said.
Sammy took off his tie and handed it to her. She fashioned it into a sash, and in a few seconds, the Moon Man was standing there in Pookie's wide-brimmed fedora and Sammy's belted suit jacket, which hung to trench coat length on him.
"Ta-da,"
said the cheese, presenting the Moon Man's new look. The Moon Man clicked, whistled, then made a la-la noise. He looked like a very tiny spy.
"Okay," Stilton said.
That's it. You go get him, slugger. She lightly punched the Moon Man on the shoulder.
Where's he going? Sammy asked.
How should I know? I don't know what the hell he's doing. I just taught him how to drive. He can't stay here. They'll come looking for him when they figure you gave them a fake.
I'm not sure they will, Sammy said.
The cheese opened the door of the Chrysler and waited while the Moon Man crawled in. She looked over her shoulder at Sammy as the Moon Man fired up the engine.
I put a switch in for him so he doesn't have to mess with hot wiring it every time.
You know how to do that? Sammy asked.
Doesn't everyone?
Okay, off you go, Sammy said, slapping the Chrysler's front fender. The Moon Man stuck his head out the window, looked at the cheese, and made a burbling noise while shaking his head back and forth.
No, said the cheese, you go.
Is he asking in a motorboat your boobs goodbye?
Go now, Scooter, go.
She waved him off as if she were releasing a bird she had nursed back to health.
You named him Scooter?
Shh, said the cheese.
It's sad. I'm sad.
She buried her face in Sammy's shoulder as the Moon Man drove out of the parking lot and turned onto the Embarcadero. Sammy pulled her close and kissed her hair as he watched the Chrysler go out of sight on the other side of Jimmy's joint.
Don't cry, Toots. Maybe someday we can have a Moon Man of our own.
Yeah? She said, pushing back to search his face for sincerity.
You don't think they're going to hunt us down and kill us?
No, of course not. Probably, if we're lucky. We might have to see a guy about that.
They heard scuffling behind them, looked around.
So this is the dame that put you through all the commotion?
Asked the kid. He was holding a white bag and was eating a glazed donut. He came out from between two cars, stood next to Sammy, pushed his newsboy cap back on his head with the donut. He gave the cheese the once over, held up the bag of donuts. Sammy took out two, handed one to Stilton.
This is her, Sammy said.
She's a little lumpy for my tastes.
Nay, hey, watch it, kid, Sammy said. I will pop you one.
That's okay, Sammy, said the cheese. A person can't help what they like.
He's a horrible little kid, Sammy said.
That's okay. I like that in a kid, said the cheese.
She leaned in and whispered to Sammy,
although we don't need a Russian having a Moon Man of our own.
Hey, you keep that ice bucket from the motel?
Sammy said.
Yeah, said the cheese. It's at my place.
Let's go get it. I need to find another jacket, too.
Sorry, but he looked like a goof in just a hat.
Chapter 26 The Knob. The law firm of Stoddard, Whittaker, and Kroc was in one of those bank buildings faced with granite, the color and pattern of dog vomit. It was a bank, but not a bank with counters and windows and whatnot. A bank where guys in suits sat at desks and talked to knobs about their money in quiet, civilized tones. The cheese and me walked in like we owned the joint, but the guy working the elevator looked at us like we were there to clean the drains. Me in my second-best suit, and the cheese looking sunny in a blue gingham number that would look natural on a farm girl from Kansas, if the cheese wasn't wearing a pair of red Mary Janes, with heels high enough to give a stripper a nosebleed.
My ruby slippers, she had said when she put them on.
Right out of the elevator there was a half-moon reception desk that was all bronze and marble, with a 40-ish dame sitting behind it looking tightly wound enough to spin the hands off a clock, and enough hairpins in her coif to pick every lock in Alcatraz.
"Can I help you?"
she said, like she meant to say, "Did you get off on the wrong floor?"
"We're here to see Alton Stoddard the Third," I told her, and I flashed Pookie's badge. As impressed as she was, I might as well have flashed a cockroach.
"Do you have an appointment?" she said.
"He'll want to see us," said the cheese.
"Mr. Stoddard does not see anyone without an appointment."
"Tell you what, Toots, you tell him I have pictures of him and his bohemian pals dressed like dames and giving each other the bent-over boogie-woogie and see if he wants to talk to us." And here I threw a manila envelope I had prepared for just such an occasion on the reception desk. The cheese set the ice bucket from the motel next to the envelope, which visibly confounded the receptionist down to her very hairpins. Flustered, Miss Officious worked the switch on an intercom a couple of times before she decided what to do, which was to stand up and continue to be flustered.
"You might want to snap things up, Toots," I told her. "We got an appointment at the Chronicle in half an hour."
This unfroze her. She said, "One moment, I'll see if he's in." And she hurried off down a hallway. "Like she doesn't know if one of the guys with his name on the window is in or not," I said to the cheese.
"I can't believe you called her Toots," Stilton said.
"You're just a hound, aren't you?"
"You better not be a hound."
A minute went by in which the cheese bitterly chastised me for tootsing another. Then Miss Officious returned and said simply, "Follow me." She led us down a walnut-paneled hallway, past several mahogany doors with reeded glass windows, until we reached the end of the corridor, where we were ushered through double reeded glass doors into a carpeted office, with another hairpin dame sitting at a desk, trying desperately not to scowl as Miss Officious showed us right into the inner office. The office was about four times the size of my apartment, with the cheese's cozy dame cave thrown in a couple of times to give it some air. The room was all Persian rugs and dark woods, law books on two walls, paintings with gondolas and golden canals on another, a gallery of windows looking out in the bay, as well as a stock ticker that was spitting out tape in the background like a mechanized chipmunk. There was an antique desk the size of a coal barge, and behind it sat a thin, balding guy in a houndstooth suit who peered at us over some Ben Franklin spectacles. He gave the cheese the once over, glanced at me long enough to dismiss me, then returned his gaze to Stilton. I could see it was the blue gingham dress and not the cheese's abundant charms that was giving him pause.
"So who are you, and what is this about?" he asked.
There were a couple of leather side chairs in front of his desk. I swung a leg over one. The cheese sat demurely in the other, and held the ice bucket on her knees. "I'm Sam Two-Toes, and this dish of loveliness is Dorothy Gale, and we are here to talk to you about what you and your bohemian pals were getting up to at your camp out last week, and more importantly, the people you killed to cover it up." He stood up behind his desk to show his outrage. He was taller than I expected, a head taller than me and thinner. I really expected a shorter, fatter guy, with a monocle, maybe a top hat. Yeah, okay, I was probably expecting the guy in the Monopoly cards.
"Now, see here," he says,
at which point I pull out Jimmy Vasco's Walther 380. "Shut the fuck up and sit down, Alton," I said. Wisely, he did.
"He said, now see here," said the cheese. "See if you can get him to say, my good man."
"The police will be here in seconds," Stoddard said. "My receptionist has already called them."
I threw the envelope on his desk and pulled Pookie's badge from my jacket pocket. Let him have a good look at it. San Francisco's finest.
"I know the police commissioner," said Stoddard. "I know the mayor."
"I'll bet you do," I said. "Give them my best. I don't work for them. That's not relevant. It's not my badge. Here, you can have it." I threw the badge on his desk.
"You think this is the first time someone has tried to shake me down?" he said.
"Oh, no, but it's my first time," I told him.
"You're doing great," said the cheese.
"Thanks, Dal."
Stoddard said, "Mr. Two-Toes, I assure you, the Bohemian Club is made up of some of the most distinguished, accomplished, powerful men in the world. We do not kill people. You have no evidence of any misdeeds at all. I don't know what is in the envelope, but it's not pictures of the Bohemians."
"How do you know that?" I asked him, pushing back my hat with the barrel of the Walther.
"Because we do nothing for which we would be ashamed.
Except dressing up like dames, worshipping a concrete owl, and killing a stand-up dame like Pearl," said Stilton. "That's how you know Alton, isn't it?" I said. "You know there's no pictures because you had some goons take Pearl's camera. Then they hurt her, until they were sure she hadn't stashed any film. That's how you know."
Stoddard stood again. "I'll have you know."
I passed the Walther to my left hand and popped Alton Stoddard in the chops with a quick right jab, knocking him back into his chair. Stilton giggled.
"Baby, sorry," she said. I said, "You probably never even met the guys who killed the general and the girl, did you, Alton?"
"I don't know what you're talking about," he said.
"Dal, introduce Alton to his hired killers, would you?" Stilton stood, curtsied, then took the lid off the ice bucket and dumped the ashes on Stoddard's desk. A cloud of powder splashed over the desk. Stoddard rolled back to get out of the wash. I pulled the last pair of sunglasses out of my breast pocket and threw it into the pile of ashes. A light of recognition went on in Stoddard's eyes, just for an instant, but I could tell he'd seen them before. That's all that's left of them, Alton. And there were others, too. You may be hearing from them. General Remy showed you his special treasure, that little novelty he thought would impress you, didn't he?
General Remy was... he was not suitable material for the Bohemians.
So you killed him?
No, we had nothing to do with that.
But you called a friend. Maybe a friend of a friend in Washington. And he told someone who told someone. And the next thing you know, these guys in sunglasses show up and start making people disappear. Well, this is what happened to them when they saw the thing you saw.
Stoddard dabbed at his bloody lip with a handkerchief and stared at the powder on his desk. Shook his head.
You could be making all of this up, he said.
But he'd lost some of his rich guy resilience. You knew your friends were going to take care of Remy, so you asked them to do you a favor and get rid of the dames who saw your little party, too. Except two of them got away.
They said they would be dancing, Stilton said. I looked over at her. Gave her a what-the-hell shrug.
Well, they did. You can't prove any of this, Stoddard said.
You're not getting my drift, Alton. I just used the picture's angle to get in here. I don't need to prove any of this. This isn't going to court or to the papers. You guys, you movers and shakers who tell other people what to do. The worst thing you can think of happening to you is maybe you lose some money. Maybe you're embarrassed. Things are different when you live closer to the bone, Mr. Stoddard. Things go wrong where I live. Real people get hurt. Real people lose their friends, lose their jobs, lose their lives. End up turning tricks or rotting from the inside down at the Third Street Sherry Society.
Alton, I know it's going to be hard for you to imagine anything bigger or more important than you and your knob pails, but this is real. This will make things real for you. I will make things real for you.
Stoddard sagged in his chair.
What do you want? We keep a limited amount of cash in the office.
I want you to call everyone off, Alton. Everyone you talk to about the general, about the girls at the Bohemian Grove, about everything to do with it. You call them and you tell them to drop it, right now and forever. They don't send investigators, they don't open files, they don't read anyone's mail or listen to their phone calls. All this, and everything to do with what happened in San Francisco is finished. You threaten them, Alton? You got them to move somehow before, so you do it again. Make it clear that this is over, do you understand?
I have no control over...
Get control. Because I'm promoting you into the real world, Alton. I will not ruin you. I will not embarrass you. I will not see you in court. If anyone I know so much as hears an extra click on a phone call, you are going to be in an ice bucket, Alton. Just like your two goons. And so will everyone in your family. Any one of my friends so much as sprains an ankle stepping off the curb, you are ashes.
You can't get away with this, he said.
Don't care, Alton. All I have in the world is a few friends and this dame over here. Anything happens to them, I got nothing worth living for. Now you can doubt me. You can send someone after me, after my friends. But if you do, you'll live the rest of your short life in fear. You think you can go over my head? Everyone is over my head, Alton. Maybe you get me, but there's a lot of people down here with me. Maybe you don't get vaporized. Maybe it's just a fillet knife slipped under that vest of yours one day when you step into the elevator. Thin and quick. You'll barely feel it. And you'll bleed out before anyone knows what hit you. Or you can say no. Tell me that I'm being outrageous. And I'll just shoot you right now.
I shrugged. Do some research. Ask your friends in Washington what happened to their guys. Although it's probably not the best idea to let them think you know too much. Because I don't think they'll think you're quite as important as you do. Remy was a general, Alton. One of theirs.
All you have to do is call them off, Stilton said in her doting on the moon man voice. It's easy.
Stoddard looked at her like he'd just awakened to find her there.
Why are you here?
I'm saving your life, Alton, she said. Sammy was just going to shoot you and leave. I talked him out of it.
She smiled, cut an ain't-eye sweet pose.
Also to carry the ice bucket full of goons.
Alton Stoddard the Third slumped in his chair like a puppet with his strings cut.
Well, call them off, all of them.
Promise, Stilton said.
He's a lawyer, Dow, I reminded her.
I promise, he said. As soon as you leave, and if for some reason they don't stand down, if someone shows up, don't just have me killed. It will mean they haven't listened to me. Call my office, give me time to fix it.
Maybe, I said. I uncocked the Walther and dropped it in my jacket pocket. Let's go, Dow. I said to Stilton. I held the door for her, but as she left Stoddard's office, Stilton turned and said, "Good day to you, sir. To you, sir, I say good day." Then she stormed out. I caught up to her at the elevator, where we had to wait and watch the floors tick up. "Nice exit," I told her. "Thanks. I didn't know when I was going to get the chance to say that again." "You did swell," I said. The elevator dinged. But before the doors opened, the cheese looked at me and said, "We could ask for money?" "Yeah. I guess I should have thought of that, huh?" Chapter 27 Sometimes Bailey and Hatch are about 30 miles outside of Barstow in the Mojave Desert when I start feeling warm enough to move around a little. I can't lie. I'm a warm-weather serpent. The hollowed-out carcass of the skate was a comfy den, but Uncle Ho has chilled me more than Summit with his fire extinguisher to make me lethargic, so he could get me in there. And although the Chinese broads who sew all the fish parts together leave me a nice exit right under the octopus, it's a little chilly for my tastes. So once we're in the Mojave with the summer sun beating down the black Chrysler, I wake up a little. I peek out, and what do I see? But the two guys in black fedoras sitting there in the front seat. Bailey is driving, going very fast. Too fast. If I'm going to get out of this jalopy, I need to slow them down some. So I slide up between the rear seats, across the floor, and I come up on the window side where Hatch is sitting. He's a big guy, and even in this heat, is wearing his coat. So I look for a good spot. I sort of stand up on the floor of the back seat. And there it is, a nice stripe of bare neck between his fedora and his collar. I bite, bite, bite. Then I slide down under the front seat. All the yelling and the waving and the drama. The Chrysler is lurching from side to side. The tire screeching. Hatch is screaming, holding his neck. Bailey is yelling, what, what? "Something bit me," Hatch yells. "What?" Bailey finally pulls the car onto the side of the road and stops. And just in time. Because of all the commotion, I'm about to barf up a five-spice rat. Meanwhile, Hatch starts to have convulsions like they do when you get them in a good spot. And he goes all stiff and twitchy. Stiff and twitchy. Now Bailey gets out of the car and runs around to the other side. Drags Hatch out onto the sand, which is my chance, because Bailey leaves the passenger door open. I slide, slick as snake's knot, out the door and onto the sand, which is hot, but not so hot I can't make a run for some shade somewhere. Bailey sees me, but he's holding his partner's head, trying to clear his airway. And what's he gonna do? Sammy took his gun. I shoot him the fork-tongued raspberry a couple of times. "You mook. Wouldn't know a Martian if he bit you. Ha! Some big rocks over there. Some shade. I make my way over. Not a bad spot. Something has hollowed out a little den. It's cooler here. And when whatever made the den comes back, I can eat it. I'll wait out the day here. But I peek my head out to watch what's going on back at the road. Bailey looks up. Sees a Chrysler identical to the one he was driving pull up. At first he thinks help has arrived. He sees the hat and maybe sunglasses. Maybe. The driver's door swings open. And the next thing Bailey sees is what appears to be a tiny spy in a trench coat, in a wide-brimmed fedora, carrying a cornet with batteries and other bits wired to it. It's the last thing he sees. There's a flash and a couple of mushroom clouds rise over the desert. Waste of venom, really. Hatch would have hung on for hours. Oh, well. I watch a second Chrysler pull away. He's getting to be a pretty good driver. Long, straight desert roads are good practice. I coil up for a nap. I don't know what happened with the moon, man. Maybe he's still out there somewhere, driving a big Chrysler, wearing my best suit jacket. Maybe he found a way home. It's 6 months now, and we haven't heard from the taxmen or anyone else involved with the Bohemians, so maybe Alton Stoddard III got the message out to his powerful pals. Who knows? We keep an eye out for anything strange. I'm still bartending, although I have a stake in the joint now, as Mrs. Sale asks me to stay on to run the place for a share in the profits. I tell her, really, Mrs. Gabelli, I don't think what they tell you happens to Sale is strictly on the level. And she says to me, "I know that Sammy Sale was terrified of flying. He wouldn't go up a stepladder to change a light bulb, let alone get on a plane in the middle of the night. He was a douchebag. His life caught up with him. End of story. You want the job or not?" Romance. Lone Jones is still waiting for his call from President Roosevelt, although after meeting Jimmy Vasco, he is now considering becoming a lesbian, as that seems like it might be easier to get into than the Secret Service. Lone and Jimmy have become fast friends, and she sometimes joins us at Cookies for late-night coffee and conversation. Bakker, the merchant marine, is getting a new snake for Uncle Ho, which Mooshoes and I are paying for out of our own pockets, although we have opted for something more portable but just as deadly, called a boom sling, so Ho can rake in some respectable doubloons in the Snake Whiz noodle soup business. Mooshoes and Lois Fong are an item going on 6 months now, and have decided to go in together on a driving school for the people of Chinatown. Lois will sing the written parts, and disrobe is needed to keep the students' attention. Mooshoes will teach the actual driving. But technically, you don't know how to drive, I tell Moo. Yeah, but in an emergency, I do fine, he says. What could go wrong? He has a point. There is a need. He has an angle. Milo is also expanding his business by serving adult beverages to his fares while driving them to work. He's driving a little more each week, in small doses, so he builds up his tolerance, and if the cops do not catch on to his game, he will be able to rent a place where he can sleep more than one night in a row. Me and the cheese. Well, it's not what you'd call a picket fence life. She's still dealing breakfasts off her arm, and I'm still tending bar and keeping company with citizens of the night. But we see each other every night, mostly at her place since mine is still infested with the kid. She agreed to stop acting like a floozy, and so did I. So we go to the pictures on my night off, or out to Playland at the beach. We have a drink from time to time, or go listen to some jazz at Lone's Club. We do the razzmatazz until the wee hours, and sometimes, afterward, we sit naked together on the kitchen floor and eat cheese and crackers off the same plate and laugh until we collapse in a heap. It's just swell. Oh yeah, sometimes, late, with the music on our record player turned down low, we dance. Afterward. The setting. The city. Location is a place. Setting is place and time. From the beginning, I knew that San Francisco was going to be the place where the story would take place. But what was in question was the time. I knew I wanted a time after World War II and before cell phones, which gave me a window of about 60 years. In a sort of emergency swing during a phone call with my editor, I picked the year 1947, which ended up being both the curse and the gift of this novel. The gift was just how dynamically San Francisco was changing at the time. The curse was that 1947 was just long enough ago that anyone I could find who had been alive and in the city at the time couldn't actually remember what happened, with the exception of one very nice guy who had come to San Francisco right after the war, and who remembered, fondly, guys taking girls over to Playland at the beach on dates. Playland ran from the 1920s to the 1970s, when it was torn down, and today the only remnant remaining is one oversized windmill, still visible from the great highway along Ocean Beach. The saloon where Sammy works is based on a real place, still in the location described in the story, on Grant Street, near Broadway, where it has stood since 1861, one of the few structures that survived the earthquake and fire of 1906. The layout and history of the saloon, however, is completely from my imagination, as is the character of Sal Gabelli. Club Shanghai, where Eddie Hsu works, was also a real place, on Grant Street in Chinatown, as I described. The Chinese clubs with dancing girls and entertainers doing impressions of Anglo entertainers had become the rage in the 30s among the nobs of Nob Hill and Pacific Heights, and continued until the 1970s. You can learn more about the Chinese nightclubs in Arthur Dong's book and documentary film, Forbidden City, USA, Chinese American Nightclubs, 1936 to 1970, as well as in Lisa See's novel, China Dolls, which tells the story of four showgirls working in the clubs in the 1940s. The Chinese community had been insulated and mostly relegated to Chinatown, the largest community of Chinese outside of China. But after the earthquake and into the 20th century, Chinese businessmen moved to attract patronage from the surrounding city. One of the first steps was to redesign the neighborhood with Chinese architecture for an authentic look. later businesses that catered specifically to the non-Chinese community, chop suey houses and businesses with self-parodying names like Fur Manchu, a fur shop, opened. In fact, both chop suey and the fortune cookie were invented in San Francisco, not China, to appeal to non-Chinese. Other businesses, like the juke houses, catered almost exclusively to Chinese Americans, and the 8-foot-wide, 4 stories tall juke house, described in Noir, was a real place, although I have no idea if they actually served noodles with the urine from deadly snakes. That tradition is still practiced today in Shanghai, according to my good friend Google. Like the juke house, other locations in Noir are based on real places that existed but are long gone now. Cookie's Coffee was a real diner in the Tenderloin, called Coffee Dan's. And like Cookie's, they catered to the theater crowd, and indeed celebrated New Year's Eve 365 nights a year. There was also a cab driver who, like Milo, served shots of liquor to Coffee Dan's patrons for 2 bits a shot, although Milo owes his particular history more to the character Henri in Steinbeck's Cannery Row, an artist who was building a boat but was afraid of the sea, than to the real-life cabbie. Jimmy's Joint, too, is based on a real spot, and Jimmy is based on a real woman called Tommy Vasu, who indeed dressed like a guy and had a weakness for gambling and willowy blondes, not redheads like Myrtle. She ran a club called Tommy's Joint on Broadway, which has nothing whatever to do with the Hofbräu Tommy's Joint on Van Ness Avenue, which is still open today and serves fine buffalo stew, meatloaf, and carved turkey and dressing every day of the year. Female drag clubs were popular in North Beach in the 1940s, and into the 1950s when the city codified hostility toward gay and lesbian clubs. The most famous of the lesbian drag clubs was Mona's 440, which is portrayed in Ellen Klage's novel Passing Strange. The Bohemian Club is also a real organization. The main clubhouse is located at Post and Taylor Streets in what is now the Tenderloin, or Lower Nob Hill, or Upper Union Square, to the more charitably minded. Descriptions of the interior of the club come from written accounts, and although I was invited to attend as the guest of an artist member, I ran out of time before I had to write the scene, so I never got there. The Bohemian Grove and the ritual, the cremation of care, complete with giant concrete owl, come from academic descriptions. I have never set foot in the grove, although I've driven by the entrance many times, as I keep a riding hovel and squirrel ranch nearby. The nefarious goings-on beyond the well-documented ritual are all products of my imagination, because nothing but rainbows and cupcakes ever comes out of secret meetings among immensely rich and powerful white guys. The neighborhoods. Most of Noir takes place in the neighborhoods of North Beach, Chinatown, the Tenderloin, and the Fillmore. North Beach has been an Italian neighborhood since the late 1800s, populated by fishermen from Italy, who migrated and brought their food and culture with them. Although in the 1940s, it was also the Mecca for the gay community, both men and women, before it migrated to the Castro, a neighborhood at the southwest end of Market Street, which was a solidly working-class Irish neighborhood in 1947, which is not to say that there weren't gay people living there, but it is pretty safe to say that they weren't out at the time. In the 1940s, the Tenderloin, while a fairly rough neighborhood today, a spongy center of poverty and street crime, surrounded by a rich crust of gentrification, was the theater district, the center of both entertainment and government, as City Hall and the Civic Center lay in its midst. Its transformation can be traced back to World War II, when the United States started gearing up for it, opening shipyards up and down the West Coast to build war and transport ships and munitions. The factories required workers, and the workers required housing, so single-room occupancy, SRO hotels, were built in the Tenderloin, to house the workers. Today, the Tenderloin rings of sad desperation. But in the 1940s, with 3 shifts of defense workers cycling in and out of the neighborhood, not to mention the entertainers and theater crowd, the Tenderloin was jumping. Cross Van Ness Avenue from the Tenderloin, and you're in the Fillmore, which was also changed radically by the war, but for different reasons. The Fillmore, known for its Fillmore Theater and the landmark rock concerts of the 1960s, was little more than a slum before the war. Many of the population living there were Japanese, and the Fillmore and Japantown were barely distinguishable. In 1942, President Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, ordering Japanese Americans living on the West Coast imprisoned in internment camps. The Japanese residents were forced to sell or store their belongings and were moved to camps up and down the coast. Another executive order, number 8802, which banned discrimination based on race and defense plans, had already caused a mass westward migration of blacks fleeing the oppressive Jim Crow South. These migrants were following the promise of good jobs and guaranteed housing and benefits. The new housing being built for workers couldn't keep up with demand, so when the homes of the interned Japanese opened up in the Fillmore, African Americans moved in. Jazz clubs began to open in the neighborhood, and by the 1950s, the Fillmore was a premier jazz destination for musicians and enthusiasts. When the Japanese were released from the camps, many returned to the Fillmore, which engendered an interesting intersection of cultures that I've written about in earlier books. A dirty job, secondhand souls. But many also moved into the new housing being built in the Richmond and the Sunset to house the families of returning servicemen, as referenced by Sal in Chapter 3 when he's trying to formulate dog pizza. The aforementioned changes to racial demographics in San Francisco have resonated through the years to shape the Bay Area into what it is today. But in 1947, the changes were new, and the city was trying to catch its breath after a great war, and inevitably, those changes affected the people. The characters. It was tough to find first-hand sources for what life was like in San Francisco in 1947, so I turned to the writings of Herb Kane, the intrepid columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle and the San Francisco Examiner, from 1938 until 1997, whose beat was the street and people of the city. Kane's work touched on every aspect of city life and often profiled colorful characters about town. In one column, he wrote about a racist cop who made it his business to try to beat the neighborhood white. Kane also reported how the cop was pulled off the street, but kept on the force because he knew where too many of the city's power elite's bodies were buried. Kane never mentioned the cop's name, but after I read that column, Pookie O'Hara was born. During the war, the African-American population of San Francisco rose from just over 5,000 at the beginning of the war to more than 35,000 by the end of it, an increase of more than 600%. And that was just in San Francisco proper, not including Oakland, Marin City, and Richmond, where there were also shipyards. Portrayals of indigent veterans in the Third Street Sherry Society were also inspired by Herb Kane, who wrote about them frequently. General Remy, and consequently the Moon Man, came out of one of my very early web searches of San Francisco, 1947, which returned one small item in the middle of the second page, posted by a UFO aficionado, noting that in March 1947, the commander of the Air Force base at Roswell visited San Francisco. The crash at Roswell, whatever it was, happened in June of that year. Only a week or so after the first flying saucer was spotted by a pilot near Mount Rainier in Washington State. There is nothing beyond that coincidence for the basis of the character of Remy. Once I knew that a general was in the city in the same year as the flying saucer sighting and the Roswell crash, well, I had a run with it. With the general came the men in black and, of course, the Moon Man. My portrayal of the welding crew on which Sammy works is largely drawn from accounts I found on the digital archive at www.foundsf.org, with the dialect drawn from the novel If He Hollers, Let Him Go by Chester Himes, an African-American crime writer from the 40s and 50s, most famous for his Harlem detective series. If He Hollers, Let Him Go is about an all-black welding crew in a World War II-era shipyard in Los Angeles. Lone Jones is built of equal parts of reality and fiction. When I was a kid in Ohio, I took part in a summer work program for junior high football players, designed to keep us from becoming criminals. It was run by the local police department, and 6 mornings a week, a cop driving a paddy wagon would pick each of us up at our homes and drive us to a strawberry farm in the country, where we would work a half day in the fields all day on Saturday. The cop would drop us off after work each afternoon. One morning, when I climbed into the back of the paddy wagon, among the 20 or so adolescent boys, mostly from the inner city, was a much bigger, powerfully built older guy of about 20. We'll call him John Henry Johnson. John Henry was indeed his name. Later, during the drop-off, we discovered that John Henry lived with his mother in a garage, heated by a single wood stove, across from a steel mill. Even guys and the crew from rougher parts of town were shocked and humbled by the poverty. I worked with John Henry for 2 summers, and came to know him as one of the strongest, most generous, and good-natured people I've ever known. He usually rode up in the front of the paddy wagon with the cop, not back in the cage with the rest of us. A slow reader, John Henry would make the driver tailgate other drivers so he could sound out the writing on bumper stickers. Because he had preferred seating in the truck, the other black guys and the crew teased him that he didn't want to be black, that in fact he was white, and only the accident of skin color caused people to misidentify him as black. Soon John Henry owned this and insisted that no, he was not black, and the rest of us backed John Henry up when we were among strangers. I can hear you cringing. It was fine. It was good. It was friendship. And it was all in good spirits. But seen through a lens of today's political correctness and horror at cultural appropriation, I suppose it is cringeworthy. John Henry Johnson was half of the inspiration for Lone Jones. The other half was Hazel and John Steinbeck's Cannery Row, a good-natured giant who becomes forlorn when a fortune teller predicts he will become president of the United States. Sammy Tuto's Tiffin comes almost entirely from my imagination, except for the improbable accident that sent him west. My own father, several years out of the Navy and working at a factory in Toledo, had his left foot nearly severed when a forklift hit him, crushing his foot against a wall. He was already enrolled and scheduled to begin at the Highway Patrol Academy, and before he passed out in the hospital, he made his mother promise that she would not let doctors remove his foot. She prevailed over the physicians, and my father went to the academy, albeit a year late, and became a highway patrolman, a job he loved and did until the end of his life. So that bit of Sammy's history and determinism to serve comes from my father's story. Mainly Sammy fit the description of what the protagonist of a noir story should be, a regular guy in a sketchy situation. Which brings me to the genre. Noir. When I first moved to San Francisco 10 years ago, I attended a charity dinner hosted by the public library for authors and readers. The theme of the event was noir. During dinner, one author at my table, an accomplished writer of crime novels himself, said, "Really, I think the best noir author was Jim Thompson." "Oh, no, no," said a nearby author of children's books, also very accomplished. "Raymond Chandler was definitely the best." In a rare exercise of restraint, I kept my mouth shut. Because, for my money, they were both right, and they were both wrong. Scholars and scribes with far more knowledge than me have made careers out of creating, curating, defining, and presenting the noir genre. But I shan't let that stop me from waxing ignorant. It seems to me that the whole noir genre comes from the term film noir, and that encompasses a whole set of aesthetics that don't always translate to written fiction. In written fiction, you have your hard-boiled detective guys, created by Dashiell Hammett, Raymond Chandler, and Mickey Spillane. Then you have your dark streets, desperate noir that usually starts with some poor, hapless working mug who gets roped into some nefarious goings-on by a dame. In that tradition, you have James M. Cain, David Goodis, and Jim Thompson. When I started noir, I envisioned it would be a work of the second type of noir, a story about the poor working mug, Sammy, and the dangerous dame who tumbles into his life, the cheese. It was going to be dark. It was going to be desperate. There would be fog and gunplay and danger. That's what I thought. I know, I know. What I ended up with is essentially perky noir, a lot closer to Damon Runyon meets Bugs Bunny than Raymond Chandler meets Jim Thompson. But what was I going to do? Noir was already typed at the top of every page. So here you go. Thanks for stopping by. Christopher Moore, San Francisco, California, June 2017. This is Johnny Heller. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Noir, a novel, by Christopher Moore. This program was produced by John Marshall Media. Executive producer, Katie Ostroka. Text copyright 2018 by Christopher Moore. Production copyright
2018 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.